Dankeschön. Also, herzlich willkommen. Ist Mundart okay? Ist Deutsch okay?
We can do girl English,
oder? English is fine?
Ja.
Okay. Everybody, alle verstehen Englisch? Okay. It's not perfect if I do it in English and then like five people are like, I don't speak English. So, yes, so you noticed something different for today, which is the colorful logo. Hello. Let's get started. We have 45 minutes. I have the timer here, so to speed through this, I won't read all of that, but that's the general outline. And as you can see, where's my other thingy? Yeah, the demo will be ready soonish. Wait, there we go. Alright, so about me, I organize stuff. I do Rust Fest. I also have a Rust Fest t-shirt here, so for those of you who will be seeing me tomorrow in this. Ernst Eisprung is a very alternative festival. Thank you. Some of you already know it. It's very great. I had some good jokes written on it. Also, if you're into making t-shirts, maybe Aufklären statt Aufregen. Or the other way around, Aufklären statt Aufregen. Yeah. Uplift or Upset. It's not perfectly translated, but yeah. Alright, tonight, yes. Basic computer networks. Common assumptions. TCP and TLS, so this will be the refresher part. If I'm too fast, just scream, yell, throw yourself on the floor. Then also, encryption is not that hard, to be honest. I switched my whole demo last night from the old Actives to the new one, from OpenSSL to Rustles, and now it supports TLS 1.3. Woo! Okay, also we will learn what the actor model is, which is probably what most people who weren't at university don't know anything about. And also RPC is remote procedure call, which is basically what you do when you type in something in your browser. Goes to another system, asks the system to do something, and returns with the result. Alright, multiprocessing. First of all, why? We could just have faster hardware, but that doesn't scale infinitely, then it's expensive as well. Plus, cooling is a problem. So we're now at the physical limit of how to heat up stuff and still cool it. If you haven't noticed, the CPU frequency kind of maxes out around 5 GHz, which is after the 5 GHz band, you just burn your CPU. So instead of burning CPUs, we just do more of them. And now every smartphone has at least 4 strong CPUs inside. And yeah. So, and also for organization, it's way better. You can do remote work, which also means you can move the work somewhere closer to your customers or users. And while moving stuff around, we also can plan ahead for redundancy if some power plant fails, or I don't know, a country loses internet connection, which also happens from time to time. Okay, how do we do that? So the first approach was multi-socket. It just had one motherboard with 2 CPUs in it. Then we had SMP, which meant simultaneous multiprocessing. So inside one socket, multiple cores. So we have now 2 4 cores on one board. Inside each core, we have 8 cores each. And then we have hyperthreading, or however AMD calls it, which basically doubles, or almost doubles, the CPUs inside one socket. And we gain additional speed up until we hit Spectre, Meltdown, and the other fun stuff, where it's just like, shut it down again. So, yeah, my last employer lost 70% of the CPU power over the last year, because
first spectrum integration, and then hyperthreading was broken, so they had to turn it off, which also cost 50%. And then, yeah, was a very expensive machine. Now it's a very expensive machine. All right. What if we can't fit all the CPUs inside one box? Right. Well, turns out these ideas already had happened. SoCs, for instance, are a network of their own. They communicate inside them with network protocols. USB, for instance, is a network protocol that's used inside and outside of boards. Then there are modern ARM chips, which have different instruction sets on different cores, which are on the same silicon, which is very interesting to me. And then you have message passing between the cores and callbacks between the cores, so your software has to be able to tell the difference between the cores. Very interesting stuff. Little foreshadowing, the next TOC OS will support that, which is great. Then our other PCI, Ethernet, Wi-Fi. So, calculation-driven, computer-driven things usually have pools, threads, OpenCL. For graphics cards, we have CUDA and whatnot. And over networks, well, we just have our stuff that we build. And that's what we're gonna do, right? We are going to... Something's funky. We're going to distribute that over many systems, and now let's look at this graph. So I made this graph in order to show you different things, and then I realized that when I do this, you will still see the original graph. So bear with me. Okay, point to point. It's the easiest of all. It's just like one thing. Bus is when all these are physically connected, and it's just like when you enter a signal here, floats everywhere. Then we have other topologies like star. Let's imagine this is our star in the middle, and we cut off these here, and we cut off that part over here, then we have a star centralized. Then we have trees. Where have we a tree? So this is not a tree, because it loops back. Right? Tree is just going away. Then we have rings. Let's imagine just this part up here, it's a ring. And then we have the whole thing, it's a mesh network. So very brief. We're running a little bit out of time here. Okay, but how can we deal with that? So first of all, we are here, we're programming this part, right? We want to have data from one process to the next process. These are separated by different machines. So all the lower layers are very generic. Okay. So what are we going to do? Okay, for the first thing, cables, we usually don't do cables anymore, which is layer one. Data link layer, it's very common. It's Ethernet. Three is IPv6, as we learned today. TCP IP is the combination of them, but TCP is its own layer, four, or UDP or SCCP or whatever. Session layer, it's not 100% clear what session layer is in the OSI model, but nowadays I would use this as encryption, keeping state line. And then presentation layer would be something like, okay, we have internal keep alive stuff, we have maybe routing inside our application, and then on top of that we have our user commands, which is usually event driven by a user doing something or not doing something. So by sending data around, the system has to package it over and over again, transmit it over some physical medium or many, and then reverse the process. And if we have routers, then we do this process up and down only to a certain degree, right? We go through many switches, we go up to this layer, go to routers, it's the next one, go to firewall, it's up here. And in the end, between boxes, it's always the lowest layer. Alright, so here are the assumptions. Of course this is reversed, because why? It's easy. Okay, layer one, error correction is very important here. We have physical problems, like noise, defective cables, echoes and whatnot. And then we make groups, and the more groups we stack, the further away we can go. So you will later see the IP addresses I give you, they're also layered in different dimensions. Then we can partition the network, we can segment, we can make a segment for private stuff, we can make a segment for lights, for the cameras, but not. And on layer 5, where I said before, it's a little bit political nowadays, I think untrusted transport is a very good topic for that layer. So it does encryption, it transits over distrusted networks. And on layer 6 we can have multiplexing, so we can reuse connections from one application to another. So if we have an application that does many things, demo application you will see later will also do many things at the same time, but it will reuse one single connection. And on top of that we can do what we want. We can play or... So, we're already here. Example project. This is the moment where like... Okay. So, if you want to play, go to these URLs, hopefully. We'll see if that's already compiled. It is, it's running. So... And this one has a self-signed certificate.
Hast du Avahi am Laufen?
A was?
Avahi.
Zum Broadcaster hast du über
das Hörer. Ah, na, na.
Was hast du für das Dichter?
Learning Security.
Arch.
Ja.
So the security warning is self-signed certificate, just accepted. It's a 4K RSA key, and the common name should be distsys.estada.ch. And the last one is only link local IPv6, so I don't know if that works. I tried to access the service from the free internet before, but that didn't work. So you probably have to be inside the Wi-Fi. Im WLAN.
Okay, ich glaube, was der Cousin Key ist.
Swiss Chaos. Swiss ist das Chaos.
Swiss Ash.
Okay. Ash and the Gallery of the World.
Is it this?
Two. Even jetzt nur sehr cool da mit den A-Clip-Teilers.
So.
Yes, yes, I will do.
Crazy. Also, refresh is just to be the left.
So. Ah, brilliant. Okay. So, I made this one. Maybe you have to scroll up here. And then you click on it, and then you should see pictures. Yeah. Share. See your pictures down here, and then you can click on other people's images and see them in between.
I think there are questions.
I'm very disappointed it's not like Rust compiled to JavaScript, it's just JavaScript.
Yeah. But I tried to do it with Elm, to be honest. But, you know, time is finite. But for the demo I used a very Elmish approach. So, yeah.
We'll talk more about the architecture later. All right. What are the goals? So there are three goals in mind with this project. First, share your images and then keep control, and also make it very easy to set up. Like, all I have to do to set this up is provide the program with two key files and then start it. Everything else is packaged and comes along. So, and of course, we do it properly. So, user stories is, first of all, open browser, browse galleries, which, yeah, we have seen some before. The other thing is share images. Click the share button, that works too. Oh, and since you are already interested on this topic, if you scroll down, you can see all the messages your client sends and receives in this gray box. This box is very helpful because asynchronous is hard. All right. So how can we split this up? So we have three roles. We have clients, we have the central hub, and we have the storage pods. There are other architectures that work like that. Blender, for instance, uses the same model for its distribution. It's called client, master, slave. Client, master, slave. Where all the storage pods are connected to the hub. The hub decides what to do and routes the traffic, and the clients always talk to the hub. Yeah. This enables us the following, which is always true, it's always non-blocking, and that's very cool. Because then we can add more and more clients, and as long as the people don't click too fast, we don't need that much infrastructure. And by the blinking of this laptop, I can tell that lots of people are accessing this machine right now. But the fan doesn't turn on, so it's not that bad. One big thing for me was I wanted to have the hub very strongly encrypted. And as I said before, TLS 1.3 is around for 9-ish months now. So there is an implementation in Rust, inside Rustles. Rustles has its own set of problems, one of them being it can't read big keys, which is not documented. Whee! Thank you, Rustles. 4K is the limit. If any key is bigger than 4K, it will fail with weird errors.
That's enough for this.
Yeah, but when you for some reason have an 8K key laying around and don't know that, then your application breaks and you're like, why?
I mean, just a random question, doesn't TLS support like non-RSA stuff? EC, whatever?
Yeah. It does, but then you would have to generate keys accordingly.
I think if you enter into like 4K is not enough directly, then you first need to switch to electric curves.
Yeah.
So that's not really a bug, that's a feature.
Yes, but sometimes old implementations are able to handle bigger RSA keys, but don't know anything about elliptic curves, so yeah. Cool. There is also another project to implement the storage side in pure Rust, so it doesn't run in the browser. But that project halted a little bit. So how can we do that? We have lots of communication around everything. Everything is async. Everything is very strange. So let's do it with Rust, because with Rust we can also add a field in one point and be sure to add it everywhere else. Because the first time I tried something like this, I did it in JavaScript, and always had like undefined is not there. So, the fuck? Okay. PDF is messing around. So, let's go through the files. CargoTunnel. You notice this is version 0.2 already. So, it's also using the latest edition, 2018. So we have all the new fancy features. And I don't know if that's valid code, but I had to fit it on the slide. So all the code that's weirdly formatted, that's the reason. 16 to 9 is not great for displaying lots of code. We're using the latest ActX 0.8,
which is based on SCD futures. If you're into Rust already, they're switching the backend, which means that ActX 0.8 should theoretically support async already. Yes.
And the 1.0 was released, I think, last week.
It's not on Crate.io yet.
It's not ActX
Web.
Yeah.
Okay, everything's fine.
Yeah, ActX Web is 1.0, yeah. They already patched something. Important for ActX users is you have to know about features. Features have to be enabled. So all the crypto stuff has to be explicitly enabled for everything. The other... That's pretty cool. Yeah, and you can switch the implementations. But the code is not abstract over the implementation. So if you use Rust TLS, then it uses Rustles underneath. If you use SSL, feature flag uses OpenSSL. And if you use native TLS, it uses native TLS. Full disclaimer, native TLS was removed for 1.0 because they wanted to get it out faster. Alright, Chrono is also very nice because the server is able to tell when last modified happened, so that's what you see in the blue box for every gallery. Everything else, if you're new to Rust, quick question, who is new to Rust?
Pretty new.
Pretty new, okay, so Cargo is the package manager.
We know that.
We know that.
Yeah. Great.
So I think it's our first package manager which can specify features, which is really quite cool.
Yeah. Serve is serialization and deserialization, and we enable it here for the time extension. Chrono is an extension to SCD time. Very cool, because then we can just tell the client, hey, this is an ESO string of a certain format that will include everything, including time zone. And what else? Oh yeah, nflogger, very handy. It logs over environment variables, so. Cool. Let's look at the layout. The Linux users know tree probably. The cargo log file is fixing the dependency. So if you clone this project and life goes on, there's a very high chance that thanks to this log file, when you compile it, you will get this, a working binary. Maybe not the same binary because the compiler has changed, or you're on a different platform, but you get a working binary. Identity files and certificate files, make file. I know make files are, well, but they're very handy for scripting OpenSSL. So the keys I generate are scripted with this make file. README for short explanation. I split up the Rust code in three: the actors, the main, the protocols. When I did the upgrade from 0.7 to 1.0, I only had to touch the main file, which is great. So, hooray. And static, yeah, somebody was like, well, it's not WebAssembly. Yes, it is not. That's why it works.
Well, I mean, from this point on, we would not be able to tell if it's WebAssembly because, I mean, it still would end up in JS, right?
I actually did a production project in WebAssembly recently, and it's really nice by now.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of things changed in the last year.
So with Rust and WebAssembly?
Yes.
Yeah. And as I said, I wanted to do it with Elm. Originally, yes. Thank you. If you have a look at the code, this debug all is very handy because it catches all and every exceptions that occur inside the browser and give you at least an alert if it can't submit it anywhere else, which is very handy on a mobile phone. You get weird errors. Okay. Oh, and another thing, inside the CSS you can now use a thing called --var, which is super great. So you don't have to use SCSS anymore. Anyhow, how do we start things? Create an object, ActX system. Why do we do that explicitly? Well, it makes it very easy to add a web server and a TCP server. So we can have different applications running at the same time. Then we need a centralized ID giver, which can be done within ArchMutex. And then we need a hub, and we just say, okay, we want to have one hub, one and only hub, have that synchronized and run that. So this SyncArbiter is already, it's an actor that's living inside the system. Okay, how get the keys? Yeah, again, doesn't fit quite well, but basically it's like this. We make a config, we read certificate, the key file, then we build the keychain, then we extract the keys, then we insert them into our server config. This is the moment where the weird errors happen if you have a too big key file. And then we return. Hooray! For those of you who are new, result is the answer to exceptions. We don't have exceptions in Rust and we're very happy. Okay. Let's start the next big actor, the web server. Web server is a class of ArcTex, and inside that we create an application. It used to be called withState, now it's called data. With data we create a couple, where you just insert incrementer and the hub. And then at that point, everybody is familiar with the builder pattern. Perfect. Okay, with the builder pattern, we stack first service, and we say this service is a resource with its path, route that to, and then everything here is to, and here we could add a next service, and we can add more and more of them, we don't, and in the end we say, okay, we bind, and this is one of the points where if you have encryption, then you have to decide which encryption, and then this call is different. Some of them require a config, some call it acceptor, some call it factory. Just give it the key material somehow, or don't at all. Alright, and what we do here already is we already handle incoming connections. So with the WebSocket library we can say, okay, we start a WebSocket actor. So every connection we have spawns a new actor in the system. And this actor you can imagine as a representative of your connection. So when your browser is connected to the server, inside the server the actor is representing you. You can't hack it ideally, but it acts on your behalf. And here you see why I have an incrementer. You have this ID, which is globally unique. It's very handy to have something like that. And then we have the address of the hub. And by default, every connection is just viewing. So if we want to share something, the pod functionality, we have to enable it with a special call. And then we're done. The second service we do here is to serve the static files. We have an index file, everything, show files, everything, and blah, blah, blah. Yes?
What's a hub and what's a pod?
Okay. A pod, in the concept, in general concept, the pod is the slave program that serves images on the request.
It's an execution unit or something?
That's more or less the idea. And then in the Rust code, a pod is a WebSocket client that serves images, that has a file listing ready on the hub.
It's a participant in the network, basically.
Yes. Yes. And why I call it a complete distributed system is because your browser runs these two functions, these two actors at the same time. So one actor is the gallery actor, which views the stuff, and the other one is the pod actor, which shares stuff.
And the hub does dispatching?
More or less, yes. Yeah. It also aggregates over time. So when we have the WebSocket and we connect, this actor gets started. And in the start command, we go to the hub and say, hey, I'm a new client, I want to subscribe to changes. So we subscribe to all new galleries that emerge or disappear. Every time the set of galleries changes, we get an update. Consequently, when the connection breaks away, the actor notices, oh, my connection is gone, I have to self-destruct or stop myself, and then we unsubscribe with our ID and tell the central hub we're gone. Huh? This enables also all sorts of cleanups, because connection can die, but we can still gracefully react to this fact. Alright. So, when we have RPC-style requests, but stuff that would normally go to a REST API, we can handle it like this. We can say, okay, we have a client request with a certain message, we send it to the hub, turn this message into an actor, and give it a reference to ourselves so it knows how to talk back to us. And when that's done, we say, okay, we answer to the client, and we're done. Future, okay, empty type. For those of you who are new, empty type is just open close brackets. Happens all the time. Yes. And here you also see the big pros of having one big protocol. We'll talk about that later. But we can just say certe, try to deserialize that. And I made a namespaced protocol, so we don't have to worry. Oops, where is my mouse? We don't have to worry about, oh, is the client allowed to send this or that? Because at the border, we can deserialize into our protocol. If it's valid or not is decided on one line. And then if the message that we received is valid, we can then pattern match it. Because now we have Rust types. So we only match the types that the user is allowed to. So the user is not allowed to send us answer commands, right? For those of you who use Zoom, did you get the message when they didn't check that? They would just process every message. So you could send a Zoom client a server command from any client, and it would just like, oh yeah, the server asked me to do that, I will do that. And one of the things was share screen and accept user input. So you could open Windows R, type in commands, and press enter. Hooray! Was great, they fixed it. Okay, yeah, your question from before, what's the hub? It's a struct. It's a hash map with all the pod information, and it's a hash map with all the client information. And the pod info contains all the stuff like what's the name of the gallery, what are the paths, when was it last updated. And this is a broadcast. It's basically a for loop which sends internal messages to all the actors that are connected. And the actors also have an inbox. And if the inbox receives a message, then it will get processed. So, quick recap on actors. What is an actor? An actor is a normal struct that has an inbox inside the system, and it lives inside the system. So, if you have an address of an actor, we can send it messages, just like email. And the actor can react to these messages, accumulate state, like this one here. This is internal state, and react accordingly. Is that more or less clear? Only message passing. Okay. So how do we react to messages? We implement the handler for a certain type. Means the type system can tell us if we missed something. If we try to send a message to an actor that it can't handle, it will tell us we can't compile. Yeah. This is how we subscribe. Just insert into the hash map with all the default information, so when a new connection comes in, the only thing we know about it is the name of the gallery, empty path, and modified now. Okay? And with that, half that, we broadcast that information to all the clients. So we receive a message from one pod broadcasted to all the clients, not the pods. What happens if we have asynchronous style, if we don't have this nice RPC, okay, that one requested something and we have to do that. Then we have async, and then we need to carry around the ID. And that's why this idea is very handy. If a client requests something, and there are certain paths that it can't do, right? Like this unreachable. I can define, at this stage, this must never happen, must be handled by something else. We'll rather terminate our server than let something weird happen. But for allowed commands, like update title, we can react, and we can, of course, broadcast again. Broadcasting is probably the one function I use the most inside the hub. Okay. What else? Oh yeah, before we go there. The whole image requesting functionality means that when you click on a gallery and the browser starts requesting the actual pixel data, it will go to the hub and ask, hey, I want from the gallery number 42, I want to have the path slash whatever. And then the hub will say, okay, this came from 23, so it will send to the connection with ID 42, will send a message, hey, 13 requested that path from you. And then it will wait, and then the pod will answer at some point, hopefully, with either a positive response, which then contains the image data, or a negative response, not found. And then we route that information back, but because these are so independent, we have to send the ID for the next one all the way throughout the system, in and out. All right. This is serialization, use serialization.json. And why did I add danger zone here? Anybody have a clue?
It's beautiful.
Hmm?
There's like perfect access.
No, it's not that. It's another kind of danger zone.
It's not that same what I use twice.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. It's not guaranteed that you don't have any conditions?
Yes, that's it. Every function that accepts pod ID will accept any U64. So, if we want to make this safe, we should switch that to a new type, which is a struct, which is a full type, so you can't misuse that. The pro for using pub type is you don't have to write .0, but that's about it. So, if that project grew any bigger, I would switch that into a new type struct and then wrap it for good without having to think about it. Yes.
But your idea would be that you cannot construct a pod ID unless you get it from an existing pod, right?
Yeah, well, I have to be able to construct that at some point.
Yes, but you encapsulate that so that the rest of the code cannot access an invalid pod ID. That's the idea, right?
No, the problem with pod ID is that you can use all functions that accept U64, even if they specify something else. So, in the beginning of the project, I had client ID and pod ID, right? And then at some point, I had a function that would only accept client ID, and by accident, I filled in pod ID because they both boil down to U64. And then I realized that it still worked, and then realize I don't need client ID, and then just drop that. But if you have a bigger project, this is just an alias, and it doesn't give you any type safety, so danger zone. Oh yeah, Archer has a new season running. Danger zone. Okay, back on topic, we already have 5 more minutes. This is the super protocol I was talking about before. So, it looks very redundant, right? Left and right, inside, outside. This is the syntax for a new type if you're new to Rust. Just name, round brackets, one thing, and done. This is that. We wrap everything, which means, in the end, we jump around here, we get these scopes, right? This is the serial format, the packed format. Of this protocol is always prefixed so that everything is scoped. It's very handy because we can match it everywhere. We have no conflict, even if we have stuff that's named the same and has the same type arguments. So, super protocol. Very handy in the end, a bit ugly to code, but usually when we have some entry point where we match the super protocol and then dispatch the sub protocols to different actors or different modules or different functions. So it's not as bad as it sounds, and it helps to pre-structure the code a bit. Okay, what can we do? Client requests, we can from browser to master. We can also define with this enum, it has to return a certain type. Right? So client response, which is not on the slide, it has to be that as an answer. We can guarantee that on the type system level. Async stuff, as I said before, it's basically fire and forget, or fire and pray. Also, side note, if you serialize stuff, you can also skip fields, or skip fields in one way. Right? Serde allows you to say, okay, this field, it has to be there, it must not be there, or if it's not there, have a default for that. We can also annotate these little functions. Very handy. What we need for ACTX is that they implement message. But we can derive that. Derive is very, very handy. Okay. How do we debug them? Because you have a hard time remembering all the time. Let's just write a print function. Oh, this is the new function, one of the new. We don't expose that function too far outside of our crate, but that's a very handy debug function where we simply create all variations that we want to use, and then once we have the full list, we can look at them, right? We can check them on the wire in the browser. If we get weird stuff, we can go into this output and say, hey, did the server do it right? Yes or no? Usually with Rust, the answer is usually yes, the server is right and the client is wrong. Very usually. And sometimes we also have this, right? It's not the same type necessarily, because it's optional. So proposed ID allows the client to propose an ID. The current implementation just says, I don't care, I don't trust you. You will always get a new ID from the server when you connect. But we could, in theory, reuse stuff like that. Responses and questions. No? Well then, thank you for your attention. Happy Pride, and we can play more with the demo if you like. Oh, and also I have one plushie to give away. Because the next Rustfest is probably November 9th in Barcelona. And you should all come.
Well, one thing that
yes.
That's not a question, a comment.
Sure.
He wants it. I want it. But don't throw it because that doesn't happen. So you include OpenCL in an actor model, but OpenCL doesn't even make sense in an actor model.
No, actor model
like,
was not
the OpenCL is mostly SIMD, like it doesn't do the work with actors at all.
That was in the beginning of how to utilize more compute power. Like CUDA is also not,
exactly.
Not really
also
an actor model.
Really an actor model.
I mean, you can run stuff independently on the graphics card and then have the graphics card talk back to you.
OpenCL can talk to heterogeneous devices.
Yeah.
So you can have a GPU and a CPU and very different types of devices and distribute your loads across all those.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure it can, but like if you start implementing actor model on OpenCL, you're gonna have a bad time.
Well, maybe if you abstract it away enough, you can use OpenCL for actor model. I mean, you can also use FPGAs for actor model, so you can use VHDL or any of the other languages.
VHDL kind of like if you use an FPGA, actor model kind of makes sense because you can make different chips and they can communicate inside the core, but just not in OpenCL. Like OpenCL is really like
Well,
one CPU which does a million threads, like one instruction a million threads or whatever.
It can do that, but I'm pretty sure you could make it handle interrupts and then it's independent-ish.
Oh, you can, and people use it for great things, but it's just like really not what they're designed for.
No, but hey, when have we ever used something for a design purpose,
well,
right?
Well,
Nobody does that.
That's actually why OpenCL is so big, is that not the OpenCL, but just the graphics card, and they use OpenCL for graphics, and it's such a common cause. That's why it really drives the costs down. So it's not really like OpenCL CUDA does, it's not what makes GPU cards cheap. What makes GPU card cheap is the actual intended purpose.
Oh yeah, by the way, the whole example that you have been playing around with, and hopefully worked, the message queue size of each actor is 10. I have never changed that, and I ran that in a very fast Wi-Fi in Budapest, and 20 people started sharing pictures over it. So, actor model is really fast. And if you don't trust me, ask Ericsson. They built their empire on actors.
I know Erlang.
Yeah, Erlang is cool. Yeah.
It's not that fast.
Sometimes.
Sometimes. It's robust.
It's very robust. Yeah, WhatsApp used to be built in it. Or it still is, maybe. I don't know.
They just use the whichever library, whichever need, and start working on it.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm waiting for Matrix to be written in Erlang. Alright, I think we should wrap up. I don't have any more stuff to give away. And afterwards, it's soon food, I heard. So, thank you again.